Ready? Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to introduce this first afternoon panel, which is going to be on NFL. And the topic is sweat equity, contracting with players and coaches in the NFL. The first person to my left is Mr. Steve Underwood. He is the Senior Executive Vice President, the General Counsel, and the Executive Assistant to the Chairman of the Board. Did I get that right?
That's a mouthful, isn't it?
Of the Tennessee Titans. He's been involved with the organization, the Tennessee Titans, and previously the Houston Oilers, for 32 years. And since 1991, he served as his General Counsel. The next person to the left is Mr. Dennis Cordell. He started out as the Assistant Executive Director of the NFL Coaches Association in 96. Then he moved on to the Staff Counsel of the NFL Players Association. And in 2006, he left that to found Coaches, Inc., where he presently works. The next gentleman is Mr. Rick Karcher. He is the Director of the Florida Coastal School of Law's Center for Law and Law and Sports. He has written extensively on all sorts of issues involving sports and the law, and he also is a former minor league baseball player. To his left, we have Mr. Anthony Agnon, who works for Eastern Athletic Services in Maryland. He's been representing pro football players since 1978, and he teaches sports law at Baltimore Law. He's also on the board of directors of the Sports Lawyers Association. And finally, we have Dave Harrell, who is the moderator of this panel. And he's the Vice President of Development of the Nashville Sports Council. And he basically oversees all sorts of development and governmental relations involving sports in Nashville. And he's been doing that since about 96. And he helped both the Titans and the Predators in their move to Nashville. He was involved in both those moves. Sure. I'd like to give the podium over.
Thanks, James. Appreciate it. I really hope there's a lot of NFL fans in the room. I know I'm one. I think I was blessed to work on an NFL relocation deal for about 2.5 years. It is probably the hardest that I've ever worked in my entire life, and it's probably the most rewarding thing I've ever done in my entire career, and I'm so pleased that the Tennessee Titans are Nashville's team. And
you and us both.
You know, and the best thing about that is every Sunday morning I'm in Lot R about probably 50, 60 paces at about 8:15 in the morning to tailgate prior to every Tennessee Titan home game, and that's something that I think definitely from a city standpoint is a lot of fun. So I know we're here today to talk to you about the NFL, sweat equity, contracting with players and coaches in the NFL. Love the term sweat equity. I think I know what it means. Definitely, I'm sure these guys have their own interpretation. But I think everyone knows in this audience that the NFL really is our national pastime. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. It's a huge baseball town. I think baseball years ago used to be our pastime, but I think the NFL by far is our country's pastime. It's definitely a huge business. The majority of teams out there, I think right now, are valued at over $1 billion per franchise. It's certainly something that I think from an economic standpoint is incredibly interesting to talk about, not only at the water cooler, but I think you all have the privilege of hearing from some guys on the front line on really the behind the scenes business aspect, because it is definitely big business. So let's go ahead and jump into probably, I think, one of the best topics at hand right now that everyone's talking about, and that's the economy. And I think what we'll do, guys, is just kind of jump around here a little bit. But let's start off with Steve, and then kind of go down the line. At what point will the NFL's economic challenges begin to have an impact on player salaries, Steve?
Well, judging from what happened with Albert Haynesworth, and in general, with free agency this year? Not yet. We are beginning, and I think most NFL teams are beginning to encounter some headwinds in our business. Now, understand that for the 10 years we've played at LP Field, we have never had an unsold ticket that we didn't want to sell. We have never had an unsold suite that we weren't trying to sell. And apart from the absence of a naming rights partner for 3 or 4 years, we've always had every sponsorship bit of inventory sold in 10 years. And Dave talked for a minute about his experience in our relocation, which was easily the most tumultuous relocation in the history of professional sports, easily. It was worth it to us economically, worth it to us in terms of fan support, worth it to us in a lot of intangible ways to move here from Houston to a much smaller market. But as the economic slump continues to worsen, we will have problems. Some NFL teams have already laid off 20, 30, 40, 50 people. We have one of the smaller front offices in the league. We have a lot of financial strength because we are so conservative about spending money and hiring people and doing the things that bog people down when the economy goes south. I'm not sure that we're going to have to do any of that if it doesn't get much worse than it is now. But if we end up in this cycle with large numbers of PSLs that don't renew, or large numbers of suites that don't renew, those are a part of the lifeblood of that aspect of our business. But I think in terms of the question Dave has asked, it's important to understand that we are a media-centric business. Everything about our business revolves around media. The biggest single piece of which is network and satellite television. We also have a significant radio element to our business. New media is becoming a larger and larger aspect of the NFL's front because people are using different distribution channels than they've ever used. But as long as people are continuing to watch us in large numbers, ratings numbers on television on Sundays and on Monday night and the times that we're on television nationally, our business is going to be at least okay. Anyway.
Dennison,
your thoughts? I don't know much more to add to that, but you made the correct point in that what I think a lot of fans get wrong is they think that these players make all this money because you have to pay $100 a ticket to go see a game. Really, that's not where the NFL makes its money. It's from the television, from the media. So as long as the media dollars are still there, which are long-term contracts, as long as those are still in place, you know, we probably won't see a huge drop-off in NFL salaries. What's going to be the big impact on the NFL with players as well as coaches who I represent is what's going to happen with this new collective bargaining agreement that's set to expire here in a couple of years.
Well, I guess I should start by saying I'm not one of the people that's on the front lines, as you say. I'm a law professor. I just ask questions and like to stir things up a little bit. I think the answer to your question, at what point does the NFL's economic troubles affect player salaries? My gut reaction to that is that it's going to affect, to the extent that teams are losing revenue, it's obviously going to impact their salaries, because whether you have a cap system or whether you have no cap, player salaries are basically, in either system, they're receiving a relative comparative percentages of overall revenue as a whole. So I think that the short answer is that it would trickle down to player salaries to the extent that there is economic trouble at both the league and the individual team level.
Tony?
Is that working? Can everybody hear that? Yeah. You noticed that the professor said he was stirring things up. Usually they blame the agent on that. So I want you to remember it was one over from me. It was not me, okay? The system that we have now that's going to be continued to be in place, as Steve said, is still set up enough that we won't have any problem here for a little while. But we're not naive enough or stupid enough not to realize that the economy affects everybody, no matter whether we would like it or not. If anybody has a 401k plan or an IRA or their parents set up anything at all, it's probably down about 30 or 40%. And those of you not opening up your statements, please open them up so that you know that no one's taking it. Just somebody else is losing the money for you. But I think that down the road, we'll see how this recovery comes about and how we're able to stem the tide, and then we'll have a better idea. Just as Steve told you, in Baltimore and in other places, we still sell out. We still have all our suites done. In Washington, D.C., they have a few open, and there are some seats that are open, although they'll tell you that they're sold out. But until we really see a massive exodus or people dropping their PSLs or that kind of stuff, we're going to still be able to continue to do business in the method that we have right now. And if we're not too stupid enough to come up with a collective bargaining agreement and come up with some ideas to make that work.
You know, Steve, from a negotiation standpoint, do you have to attack a negotiation dynamically different given the current market conditions? Is it a whole new set of challenges facing you when you're sitting there trying to figure this out?
Well, I hope what I do in my role is, as our chief operating officer, is try to look at the big picture. You know, what people are interested in, at least in my experience, is professional athletes on a field. And if you don't have high-quality players in whatever philosophical football approach your coaching staff wants to take, you know, Jeff Ball is built around a dominating defense and a strong running game. And so you have to have players that, you know, fit him. And whatever the market is what you have to pay for them. We have a general manager who's fairly conservative. I think Tony will tell you about overspending for players. But, yes, what we pay in player salaries and the benefit cost of players is by far the largest part of our budget. But you have to keep your eye on the ball, and the ball in this case is making sure that you have a superior product or a credible product to put on the field. Because if you're not getting that done, then all the rest of the wagon train is going to fall off.
You know, Tony, I think a lot of times everyone talks about the big stars in the NFL, but are you hearing just from maybe your perspective or any of the panelists about some of the guys that are league minimum salary players? Are they concerned about the current economic conditions and how that impacts them?
Well, I think that any player, even the star players, feel that you know, they're not sure how the economy is going to work out. We're in the process of trying to figure out an executive director this weekend. We're also trying to figure out whether we're going to be able to get a collective bargaining agreement together. We've had labor peace for so long. We're entering a kind of a new phase. We will enter an uncapped year next year for the first time since I've been involved in this process. So I think it affects everybody. Obviously, it's not the guys that are on the exact low end, but it's a veteran player who is making the minimum compensation for his year. Say, for example, he's a sixth year, seventh year player. He now makes a level of about $675,000. He can be replaced by a guy who comes in the league at $295,000. So the question comes down to now is, economics-wise, if this player is almost as good as the other player, who are you going to pick? And if the environment of the economics is not good, for the front office, then there's going to be some pressure put upon them by the owners to say, take the guy at 295 rather than the guy at 675. So you have those kind of situations that have come into play and the dynamics that have come into play. Now, there's a minimum that the teams have to spend right now. When the new uncapped year comes in effect, there will be no minimum, the way I see it. And therefore, then at that point, the teams can kind of pick and decide the way they want to do it. So we're really at a cusp. You're going to get a chance to really see how this process goes through for us. Both Steve and I have been around for probably, you know, I'd say, yeah, that's long is a nice word to say, over 30 years. And we have watched the system evolve. We're hoping that it does not crumble at this point. So that's a concern. And anytime you talk about economics, no matter what anybody says to you, if you can take and pay $5 for the soda, you're not going to pay $10 for the soda if it's about the same kind of soda. You know, so there's always going to be some of that naturally. All these people are businessmen. This is a business, despite the fact that it's entertainment. And as my wife tells me all the time, we're in the toy department. But even the toy department has some aspects of the business thing.
Rick? Just a little twist on that. The converse, though, is that in an uncapped year, now you pull off the restriction, that pull off the cap, and then you've got the haves that can spend whatever they want. And that really is what's going on. The bigger issue here is the revenue sharing piece between the owners right now. And they, you know, I mean, when the 2006 deal was reached, you know, the next day the owners were complaining about a lot of things, one of which was, what did we even agree to in terms on the revenue sharing piece? I mean, and what I mean by that is that the precise details of how the revenue sharing would work when that 2006 deal was signed, and what, just to be clear, what we mean by revenue sharing here, just a basic example is, you know, you have a system where under a cap, you have to have, you don't have to, but in theory, revenue sharing is a necessary component of any cap, which puts a floor and puts a ceiling on the amount that each team can spend. And so what the revenue sharing does is it creates a situation where the higher revenue teams, the large market teams, end up funneling money to the smaller market teams in order to reach the cap level because of the huge disparity in revenue that exists right now between the haves and the have-nots. That disparity in revenue has been widening since they started this cap in 1993. It just keeps getting worse. you have teams that are grossing, you know, over $300 million and some less than $200 million. And the smaller market teams are saying, hey, you know, we can't operate in this system and those small market teams are saying, give us some money. The larger market teams are saying, hey, make some more, generate some more revenue at the local level like we do. I mean, this is the constant battle. And then the small market teams say, hey, well, we don't have the ability in our market to generate the revenue you do because of the size of your market and because of the sponsorship dollars that are not available that you have, as well as the local broadcasting deals that you have. And so the share of the revenue, that whole process has not has been a serious bone of contention between the owners right from day one. And so that's one piece. And then the second piece is obviously what is, and this is from the player's perspective, you know, what is that percentage of guaranteed revenue that we can expect to get out of the deal? And in the NFL right now, it's up to 59, last season it was 59.5% of all league generated revenue, which includes local revenue. It didn't used to prior to 2006. And then the new deal, what they did agree to, the union and the league, is we're going to share, you know, we're going to get a guaranteed percentage of total league revenue. And that was a big win for the union. And there's another source of contention right there that the owners are questioning. Hey, you know, why do you get now this huge percentage of both, of all revenue, local and national revenue. So, I think that I would be surprised if there's a work stoppage, but we can discuss that when you want to at some point on the panel.
We'll press ahead, maybe here in a few minutes. Dennis, let's kind of start with you a little bit. I mean, we talked a little bit about the some of the smaller market teams versus larger market teams. Do you see, is everyone kind of in the same barrel from an economic standpoint? Are the smaller market teams going to be more pushed and they're going to have to rely on the league? What's kind of your opinion on that?
In my opinion, the biggest difference between the owners, not necessarily comes from the market size, but more of the old school family owners versus the guys who've gotten in the past 10 to 20 years, the more businessmen type, who weren't necessarily the long term, we're the founders of the NFL, this is how we treat people, this is how we do things. The people who've gotten into the league more recently have been much more, you know, we come from corporations where we've run them very successfully, made a lot of money, here are things that we do in business, here's how we treat people in business. Essentially, we're talking about Nashville here. I mean, move from Houston to Nashville, that's from a big market to a smaller market, but it makes more economic sense. You have a team like Green Bay who uses their stadium something like 135 days a year with other events. So they're a very small market, but yet they find ways to generate revenue. And you have teams that are always against the things that are, they're quote unquote the small market teams like a Ralph Wilson and a Mike Brown in Cincinnati, but yet both of those stadiums are Ralph Wilson and Paul Brown stadiums. So, I mean, you see, it's the larger, not necessarily the larger market teams, but the teams that generate a lot of revenue, they don't want to be dragged down by the teams that they feel aren't carrying their own weight. And what the union did back in 2006 was they said that, you know, why should we only get a piece of the national television rights? You know, we have teams like the Redskins and the Cowboys and the Giants and Jets that are making a lot of money locally. We want to make sure that our players get a piece of that money as well. And that's what caused some of the contention between the different markets. I wouldn't necessarily say large or small, but teams that generate a lot of revenue and those who don't.
Steve, from your perspective, are there some things that you all are working on right now from a Titans standpoint to combat the economic challenge?
Well, I think Rick and Dennis are both right in some of their observations about the labor issues in terms of revenue sharing and market size and family ownership versus corporate kind of ownership. We, of course, are an organization that is family owned and have only had one owner in our entire existence. And we moved here to get a stadium, which is another piece of the same puzzle that Dennis and Rick were talking about, because you have to have a modern stadium to generate the kinds of revenue streams locally that it takes to support a team. And in this market, a small, much smaller market than Houston, we sell 174 suites, and in Houston we had only 60 suites, and we had trouble selling those. There are so many variables and differences in stadiums, in markets, in individual clubs' abilities to generate local revenues, because you can take a team like us in a relatively small market, and we have done, I think our marketing folks do a superb job getting every dollar that they can out of the marketplace here in terms of local revenue. But again, speaking of the variables, our suite prices are reasonable compared to our sister clubs. Our ticket prices are very reasonable compared to our sister clubs. Our ticket prices are among the lowest in the league. And all of those things have an impact on the amount of money that you can generate. Indianapolis, which is a highly competitive club in our division, just built a new stadium that has 6,000 fewer seats than our stadium has, and Indianapolis is a slightly larger market. They have fewer suites in the Indianapolis new stadium than we have. So much depends on what teams think that they're able to do in their local market, how much revenue is available to be gotten out of the market, how good your sales staff is, how imaginative they are, what kind of things they can do. Here we are in one of the, in size-wise, one of the smaller radio markets in the country. We have the fifth largest revenue radio rights deal in the league. There's a reason for that. Some of the reasons are that we have really good people selling our radio rights package 10 years ago. We have people who here locally who understand the impact that radio can have. We have a very large network. We have over 80 stations in our radio rights distribution package. So you have to have people who understand their market. You have to have a stadium that you can use to capitalize or exploit the market that you're in. And the league is, as Dennis and Rick observed, going to have to come up with a way to equalize revenues between better than we have between the large revenue clubs and the small revenue clubs, because if the point of this particular part of the discussion is how are small market clubs going to compete with large market clubs over the long term, the answer is they are not going to compete effectively if you can't do better equalizing revenue. And I would say the same thing in a different way than they have said it, which is that the old guard of the league understood and appreciated that revenue sharing was a necessity. It is the lifeblood of our league. Our league is built around revenue sharing. All of the money that we get nationally for radio, for television, for satellite television, for new media, for digital media, for all of the things that are over the horizon is shared equally among the member clubs. Apparel rights revenue based on club marks and colors is all split up 32 ways. If the Cowboys sell generate $10 million worth of royalty revenue as a result of their apparel sales, all that revenue that's related to their mark is divided evenly among the member clubs. And that is what the old guard, what the older owners believed was necessary to do for the league to survive. It doesn't make any difference if Dallas is the most popular club. They still got to play all the other clubs, you know, sooner or later. I mean, they're in a league. It is not every man for himself. And there are people in the league who subscribe to the every man for himself philosophy. And I don't believe that that's in the long-term best interest of the league.
Let's shift gears. I think if you follow the NFL, everyone's heard of the name Gene Upshaw. Tony, we'll start with you. What impact do you think Gene Upshaw had on the NFL, and why do you think he was so successful, maybe against some of his counterparts in his industry? Why do you think Gene had such a huge impact on the NFL?
I think that Gene was the figure, the right figure at the right time, and that what he was able to do was he was able to set a clear path, you know, after the strike when basically things were in shambles and the players had no money. Gene was able to take the opportunity at that point to get the players all pointed in the right direction. And he was able to bargain in a fashion where he could build on each time, be able to build and get to understand what was important to the players. He also was invaluable in that he listened to the attorneys that surrounded him. They filed several lawsuits which resulted in major gains. One was free agency, and he realized free agency was what it was all about. The interesting thing is, right before Gene passed away, his last statement was, if there's no cap, there will never be a cap. I believe that there are, as Steve pointed out, several owners that feel very strongly, as Gene did, that there should be no cap. And they're setting themselves up already for an uncapped year and to do that. Gene's legacy will be go down as one of the greatest tenures of any labor union official. He'll also be tainted to a certain degree because of the most recent battles with the ex-players, where he did not really look very enlightened when he would not pay the players for their likenesses, the guys that went before. Probably our biggest mistake, or the union's biggest mistake, and the biggest black mark against Gene, is the fact that there are so many players now that are incapacitated in some way, shape, or form, and we've yet to really address that issue. Other than that, Gene will go down as a guy who was able to keep things together and get them on the right path. And we'll see how, whether, like with Roselle and then Tagliabue and Goodell, whether we have the same kind of leadership and continue on, or whether we see what the difference will be.
Rick, any thoughts on?
Just to add a couple things. I mean, there's no question. Free agency, number one. I mean, he brought it to the players, and that's a big deal. And he deserves credit for it. I think he had a unique perspective, because different from the other union leaders, from the standpoint that he was a former player. I think that added value to his leadership and being able to relate to players and what they go through on a daily basis and what their needs are. I think he was criticized for having a cozy relationship with Paul Tagliabue, the former NFL commissioner. The flip side of the cozy relationship is that's what it's all about. I mean, they were, you have a union and a league, and they have to reach a deal. In collective bargaining, there's no judge to say, you're right, you're wrong, and you've got to work out your differences, just like any transactional attorney would dealing with another somebody on the other side of the table. So I think that shouldn't necessarily be a criticism. I don't think that the retired player issue, I don't feel as strongly that should be a black mark on the way he handled that situation. Granted, I know he will be viewed by some as that being a black mark, in how he's dealt with the retired players. But the reality is this: he's running a union that is no different from the standpoint of any other labor union that looks after the best interest of its members, its current members. And he is at the direction of his members and accomplishing what they want to accomplish and achieve. This is an issue in every labor union out there between labor and management, in terms of how retired workers are treated by the current union and the current management. So that's my two cents on that.
I actually worked for Gene as a direct employee and was in the same building for Gene during my time at the Coaches Association. And I think Gene was one of the most powerful leaders that I've ever been around. He had a presence when he would walk into a room that lets you know, this is Gene Upshaw, I'm the head of the union, I'm here to talk business and get things done. When you're dealing with a union like the Players Association, the NFL, it's not the same as an auto workers. We're going to have people working for 20 to 30 or 40 years. The average lifespan of the NFL player, the player that the union is really set up to protect, is 3.5 years. Okay, and these are young guys. So you're dealing with young guys, many who don't have a college degree, who aren't in the league for very long. So they're very influential people. In fact, that they can be, they don't necessarily learn all the background of where things are and how they got to be that way. They don't necessarily know the history. So what I think Gene, one of his skills, I love the show 24. I don't know if you guys watched that. Jack Bauer's a guy who, he just gets it done. He doesn't care about all the procedures. He wants to make sure that he gets the right thing done that he believes in. In my opinion, that's the way Gene operated. Gene had a...
Even if it means torturing somebody?
He didn't torture him. I wouldn't put it past him. He's a tough guy. He came from the Raiders, too. In fact, our computer system in the office was named Raider. Definitely had an influence from Al Davis. One of the things that he'd do, though, is that he would make sure that the NFL reps, the way the union is run, is that each team has a rep, and those reps then vote on union policy. And those are the team reps that will be voting this weekend on who is his successor. Gene made sure that the guys he had in place were Gene guys. Now, that gave him continuity. He was there for a very long time. But also allowed, whether that's the right way or the wrong way, It allowed him to make sure that the message that he wanted to get across and the policies he wanted to get through were taken care of. And that's not necessarily an easy thing to do with a union that turns over its membership so quickly. And I think that's one of the things that Gene really did a great job of, was making sure that he got what he wanted accomplished. And where he took the union from where it began, as far as a business organization, it's got huge reserves. I mean, they own two buildings in downtown Washington, D.C., as a reserve fund in case they do have to go on a strike. So there's a lot of money that the union has that players can fall back on. When for a time there, they were taking out loans just to pay for legal fees. And I think that's one of the things that Gene really did a great job of. Was a very, very strong leader.
Steve, any comments on Gene?
You know, he was not only a great labor leader, but he was a great player. And I think, you know, replacing someone of his stature is going to be a difficult thing for them to do. I think Gene's legacy will always be that we had, you know, 15 years of labor peace during a time when club revenues were over which doubled and tripled. And players, you know, did better under his tenure, during his tenure, than any other time in the history of the league. I'm not sure I share Tony's view about him being disaffected by the older era players, because, you know, the truth is he tried to do a lot for them as well, and then persuaded the league to do a good bit for them that they weren't already doing. But it'll take a very interesting guy to fill his shoes.
Well, let's talk about that, maybe, Tony. What do you think some of the characteristics and qualities of Gene's successor? What is that person going to have to embody to be successful, knowing the challenges that are really facing that particular person? What is he or she going to have to do to be successful?
Well, there's going to be several things. First of all, no matter what Rick and Steve say, he's got to address this issue. He's got a $28 million judgment that he's appealed, and he's going to have some issues. They have some major issues there, some fence mending. The next guy in here is going to have to mend those fences with those guys. There's going to be, that's one of the first things that he's going to have to resolve. And his list is going to be very long on what he has to do. You know, we're facing, you know, labor unrest for the first time, as Steve said, in 15 years. We're facing owners who are pitted against each other. And this person is going to have to be able to talk to those owners, because we have owners already who are setting up for the uncapped year and setting themselves up to go after every player they possibly can get. And, you know, Rick said the haves and have-nots is very true. There are also some guys in here that want to sell their clubs to get out from under. They very much want to get out. And there are other owners, on the other hand, that are thinking, you know what, this is my chance to win the championship, no matter what the cost, because I'm still okay and I'm still having a pretty good amount of money. So this labor leader is going to have to take those. That's just one little area of problems. We are going to have a very divisive election. We already know that no one that gets elected Sunday is going to have a majority of people on their side. Even if we have a split among the three ways that they went, or the four ways that's going to happen, you're going to have representatives that are upset over the process, that don't think the process was handled well. You're going to have guys that think that the loyalists that were, you know, there were some shots taken to their candidate. So they have to walk out of the room in a united fashion. To do that in a short period of time, this guy is not only going to have to be a great labor leader, he's going to have to be a tremendously skilled negotiator. And unless he's going to have that to deal with. In addition to that, he's got to set his own agenda. He's going to have to decide, okay, even though we have a lot of money, like Dennis said, we don't have as much money as we had before this downturn in the economy. What are we going to do? Can we handle keeping those two buildings? Are the rents still working? Everything okay? They're going to have to look at their balance sheet. In addition to that, they're going to have to take a look at Players, Inc. Is it being run properly? Is the money funneling back? are the players going to demand their money back for Players Inc.? And are we going to have a new waiver for the players as they go through this process? All those things are going to have to be resolved, and all those things are going to have to be looked at. So you can see the guy that's going to get this job, and I say guy because that's who the last four candidates are, is going to have to really reach out. In addition to that, there's 40 of us that are probably going to file a lawsuit because somehow or another, and I don't know how it happened, my Social Security, along with all my personal material, was sent through a distribution chain. Now, I'm on a board of a bank. You can only imagine how the Department of Treasury is rather sensitive about that information and how where that went and everything else like that. So there's probably going to be either a lawsuit or there's going to be a discussion on what happened. We haven't had any discussion whatsoever, and it hasn't come out very much. So all these areas.
And you're referring to Troy Vincent?
I'm referring to, we don't know who we're.
What the information that you're
talking about. The letter I got just said that my information was compromised, and I have to.
But I'm just saying it's a right. You're talking about in connection with. What is this in regards to?
We don't know.
Oh, okay.
We don't know. The letters only said to us that our information.
Because that's what was reported in the media. That's why I asked. Okay.
And we don't know.
Right.
We don't know whether Troy Vincent, whether it was somebody else, how it got distributed.
I see.
We've not been notified. All we've been notified is that they have outside counsel who's looking into us, and we've retained our own counsel to continue to decide what the direction is going to be. We have no idea yet. So you have, again, even if he's not elected and somebody else elected, we want to know why that information got out and where it was. These are all the things that this next leader is going to have to take on. In addition to that, now that I've put all that compartmentalized, he then has to look at the strategy. He then has to look at the opportunity of where are we going with the new agreement. Are we going to go into the uncapped areas? Have we decided that this is enough of having that kind of agreement? And if there's going to be a lockout, if they're going to decide at that point to disband the union, go back to the lawsuit method, all these things are going to be there for him to go. And I'm sure Rick and Dennis and Steve can tell you about a lot of other things that he's got to look at.
Dennis, why do you think the NFL has been able to avoid a labor stoppage since 87? I mean, what's your thought on that?
Gene and Tyler Boo's relationship, in my opinion. I mean, Gene.
You really think that the relationship at the top end was really the critical mass?
And one of the things with the union, the power that a union has, the leverage, is its unity. You know, we heard our keynote speaker talk about how SAG became fragmented, and Doug Allen, who actually was Gene's right-hand man for many, many years, one of the reasons Gene wanted him out was because he was so pugnacious. And the guys on the other side of the table in the NFL did not particularly care for Doug Allen. Well, he goes out there and, wants to stir everything up, and that doesn't quite work. He doesn't work to get a deal done, as Gene was so good about doing. So Gene had a very strong union, and Gene really controlled the players. Another thing Gene also does, I don't know if you guys realize, the officials are also a union. Tom Condon, who was Gene's agent, a very powerful agent, works for CAA. Tom represents the officials and their union. Well, the reason that I'm doing what I do today, Gene took over the Coaches Association back in 2005, where I used to work. And so really the Coaches Association is not a union, but they are a department of the NFL Players Association. So essentially, Gene Upshaw controlled all the labor involved with the game, the players, the officials, and the coaches. So that gives you a lot of leverage when you're dealing with the other side. Gene wanted to be able to shut down the game, and Gene had that leverage. One of the things that we heard about, one of the challenges for this next executive director, not only is he going to have to unify the players who feel that maybe this process wasn't quite the most fair, there's an office downtown D.C. of 90 people that is also extremely fragmented right now. The people who are in charge, Clark Gaines, who's now the assistant executive director, Richard Bertelsen, who's the interim executive director, Tom DePasta, who's the general counsel, these guys have all been there for 20, 25 years. So there's the old guard there, the union, that were, had their allegiance with Gene Upshaw. Last year, after the Players Association meeting in Hawaii, it came out that Troy Vincent was trying to start a coup, and Gene did not like that. That wasn't in Gene's plan. So Gene actually had staff meetings to tell people, if you're aligned with Troy, you know, you're going to be fired. I'm going to find out who you are. You're going to be out of here. My Jack Bauer reference, you know, he's going to take care of you, you know. So there's a group of people in that office that don't want to see Troy Vincent become elected because they feel that, you know, he's going to have payback for these people that threw Troy under the bus. So if it's not Troy, or depending on who it is, there's going to be an extremely fragmented office of people who worked in the union for a very long time. You know, they kind of dealt with Gene how he wanted them to deal with him. And with a new guy coming in, most likely he's going to change things up, and that's going to be very hard for some of these people who've been there for a long time and done things the same way. And a lot of that experience there, in my opinion, is going to be shaken up for just to shake things up. And I don't know they're really ready to handle that. I don't think they understand the impact that that's going to have.
All right, let's really shift gears. Steve, explain the franchise tag system.
I was just fixing to take off on Dennis's closing remark about all the people that are there that have only known the one leader. One of my favorite Bible verses is Exodus 1:8 that says, a new king arose up over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And the same thing is happening in the union. As soon as somebody else new shows up that nobody knew and nobody knows and has ever worked with, it makes it very difficult. The franchise system was part of the compromise in the original White settlement and the franchise and transition players, which allowed a team to protect originally one player and two transition players. The franchise system was built around the concept of whoever that was being protected getting the average of the top five players in the league at that particular position, or set of positions in the case of maybe offensive linemen, for example. And there, of course, is great resistance among some of the players. We've designated a franchise player this year, our tight end, Bo Scaife. And it is, you know, it limits his ability to use the free agency tool for shopping his services, depending on the kind of tag that's applied to the player. But it's a methodology for a team to be certain it can protect at least one player. I have a feeling that when they originally did it, and Tony may be able to shed some light on this, it was actually designed for the Tom Brady type player, as opposed to whoever that we weren't able to protect or didn't feel like we needed to protect some other player, such as Bo Scaife. I think there's some resentment in the player community toward how the tag is used. But again, Tony would be in a much better position to talk about that. But that's essentially how it works.
Tony, is it fair? Is it effective?
Steve is right. Originally, the premise was we never wanted a team to be able to collect quarterbacks. And it's really based on the old AFL days. The smartest thing that the AFL did was they went and signed a lot of quarterbacks from the NFL that were going to come over. And it ended up forcing the merger, I thought, at least, you know, when Brody signed.
Joe Namath.
Yes, I mean, those guys all, I thought those were the, you know, when they started raiding the NFL quarterbacks, I mean, when John Brody signed to go to an AFL team, all of a sudden we got an
agreement. Everybody set up and took notice.
So that was what it was originally set for. Unfortunately, it's become what it has become, and that is a player comes free, he's about to come free, therefore he becomes your franchise player. Obviously, in the term itself, franchise, we were expecting that would be just what Steve said, a Tom Brady.
If you had a world-class running back or something.
Right,
you know.
Exactly. Somebody that was really skilled, that was so important to your franchise, LaDainian Tomlinson, somebody like that who was so unbelievably good that really we saw it as a ticket guy, somebody that sold tickets
right.
for the franchise. And it's since changed over the years. And guys resented very much, even though it's a lot of money. And believe me, you know, John Abraham was a guy who was franchised twice, and it certainly made him enough money. It was not an issue of money. But the fact was, you'd like at that point to try to figure out what you're going to do and an opportunity, and that's where it's evolved from there. Now, when this if agreement runs out, eventually they get to keep the two transitions in the franchise, so it'll be three technically franchise tags under the new.
Well, and I think it's important to note too. I haven't heard it said here. I think everybody on the panel probably realizes, and a lot of people in the audience too. Restricted free agency moves from 3 years to 6 years, which is going to mean there's a lot of players who would otherwise be free agents who are going to be sort of caught in the net. There are plenty of incentives on both sides for everybody to come to the table and make a deal.
Rick, let's talk a little bit about rookie contracts. They're very different than some other leagues. What's your take on how the NFL does it? Do you like it? Or are you against it?
Well, I don't have personal experience negotiating rookie contracts, but just from the general framework of it and how it's compared to the other sports, this idea that the rookies in the NFL are getting paid too much, I don't buy it. I mean, I think given you look at, there are only a few players every year at the top who are making lots of money, relatively speaking. But in the grand scheme of things, the entire rookie pool of players, it basically makes up, something like 4% of the total, percentage of revenue that goes to the players. I don't think that that's a lot as a whole. I think that my personal opinion is that there should be, no restrictions on signing of rookie players. I mean, to me, a draft is a restriction enough. I mean, come on. I mean, any more restrictions that you put on top of a draft to me is is too much restriction, which is so then it gets into what baseball does. They have a draft, but there are no restrictions on the salaries or the bonuses, I should say, that the players make. And of course, it's hard to compare the leagues, because you have players that are coming out of college in football that can immediately step onto the field and contribute, whereas in baseball, they're going to have to spend, a few years in the minor leagues. I guess the counter to that is maybe the part of that is because of the way the draft rule works, in that here's the league dictating, hey, you can't come into our league until you're 3 years removed from high school, which, by the way, violates antitrust law completely. I mean, and to tell in this argument that it's exempt from the non-statutory labor exemption is a complete joke, because here you have the league and the union. Or I should say the league, implementing a rule that affects players who are not even in the union. They're not party to this relationship, and you're putting a complete restraint on their ability to market themselves, which I don't believe the policy justification for, and I'm going off on a tangent here, but the policy justification for restricting those players, I don't think it the policy justification for the non-statutory labor exemption works in that circumstance. But those are just some initial.
Okay. All right, we're going to take one last question for me, and then we're going to open it up to the floor. And I know not all the panelists can answer this question, but just personal opinion, what's the likelihood that there will be no salary cap for 2010?
I think it's a given.
You think it's a given that it'll be uncapped?
I think it's a given at this point. We're by the time they get a labor leader and by the time he comes up with an agenda and everything else, I think we'll actually see the 2010. Okay. If I know there are four or five owners right now that are making sure that they're going to see the 2010 non-cap year or come up with a system where they can say all that dead money they have on their books comes off. I mean, they're certainly preparing for it. Well, I mean, if you saw that contract that has been mentioned before, there's a big bonus payment that will be paid, or they'll be guaranteed money instead. And if there's no cap, then that bonus will be paid, and if not, that'll be guaranteed salary. So basically, I think we're already starting to prepare. And from our side, don't kid yourselves, we're preparing. I mean, you know, we're making sure that we try to put ourselves in a position that, you know, and when we negotiated these contracts, there are certain guys that are up after the 2009 season, and there's a reason for that. You know, we weren't exactly sitting there not thinking about this 4 years ago or 3 years ago to realize that this could happen. And if you weren't, then you weren't. We're kind of sleep at the switch.
The other thing, my thought is that they have a year and a half basically until the 2010 season starts to work something out. And my only question is whether both sides want to go down that path. I mean, I think there's a lot of unknown. If you have an uncapped year. You know, they've had a cap since 1993, and you know, the unknown of entering that entire, you know, space of not of operating in a system that is completely foreign to you, and then, you know, the risk of possibly, you know, not being able to go back to a cap. I just think that maybe both sides, you know, might not want to. Go down that path of uncharted waters and, you know, and test it. And in the end, you know, possibly work something out at the last hour, like you had, you know, in the 2006 deal. And I don't see a labor stoppage happening. That's just my opinion. The reason I don't think that there would be a labor stoppage is simply from the fact that it's a very extreme, drastic measure that nobody wants on either side. And when it happens, it's when there's a fundamental disagreement between the two, like in baseball in 94. It was, you know, the league was adamant on a cap. The union was, no way are we ever going to have a cap. Boom. But this is a little different situation because they've had a cap, you know, for so long. And if the league wants to take the position, hey, no cap, you know, okay, so then the players are sitting there going, okay, is this really something for us to strike over? I mean, fine, we'll go without a cap. I mean, let's go, free market. Capitalism, let's do it. They had 70% of the league revenue, according to the union, in 93, you know, before the cap was actually implemented under free agency, true free agency. 70% of league revenue went to the players without a cap. Now, you know, if you look at baseball without a cap, They've had league revenues. They've you know, players without any cap whatsoever, without any, what we're talking about is no guaranteed percentage of revenue going to them. They've had upwards of 63% in league revenue that's gone to them. And that doesn't even take into account the difference between football and baseball, which is that you have these huge expenses going to the farm system for which the league is receiving no revenue whatsoever. So if you want to tack on more to the 63%, in theory you should, in terms of how much they're really getting of the total piece of the pie. So,
thanks, Trey. There's obviously a wealth of knowledge and experience with this panel, so let's go ahead and open it to the floor for questions. Sir?
I have a problem with the misconduct clause and how it's interpreted city to city. Mike Tyson incident in Indianapolis. If it happens in Las Vegas, they arrest the woman. if somebody explain to me, maybe Tony could show, how this is interpreted, because from just a casual fan's point of view, we encourage people to be aggressive, to take chances, and then all of a sudden when this same conduct steps outside of the arena, we'll take a Pac-Man joke, we'll take a Michael Vick. The misconduct clause puts these people on the street. And I'd just like to get everybody's take on how that's interpreted. Large market, small market, medium-sized market. That's the way I see it. I don't know if it's done that way, but I just like how public opinion plays into whether or not Leonard Lewis running over somebody in St. Louis and still playing football, and Michael Vick's dogs get choked in Virginia. He's not.
Yeah.
misconduct?
Well, most of what you're talking, some of the examples that you're raising there are at the league level, right? In other words, the commissioner disciplining the player because they've done something that they believe is not in the best interest of the game or something, you know. And that's a great topic because when you look at, and it's going to be an issue, I think, with the new collective bargaining agreement in football, because in football, notice he's raising the examples of these situations in football and not in the other sports. And the reason I say that is because the commissioner has much more authority in football than in the other sports, solely by the reason of the fact that the commissioner's disciplinary action is not subject to review by a neutral arbitrator. They don't have that in football. It's not in their collective bargaining agreement. It is in the other sports. So when the commissioner disciplines a player for whatever reason, the player can appeal it to a neutral arbitrator who reviews that decision for just cause and looks at, okay, what did they do? Is this something that impacts the field? You know, is it something that impacts the play? This is, like you say, it's outside the arena. It's at home or it's whatever. You know, why are you disciplining this person? And looking at past precedent, for example, what have, prior players received from a disciplinary standpoint? And at the team level, you don't see it as much. Disciplining for those reasons, things that happen outside of the workplace, and which is, I think, sort of telling because, you know, I would think that the team would be the one, the employer. The team is the employer. If there really is an issue that this player should miss some games or be disciplined from the work environment, well, then the employer should do it. But why doesn't the employer do it? Well, probably because, it doesn't impact the work environment. They can catch touchdowns, or, you know, catch passes and throw passes and hit people, regardless of what they did at home the night before or the day after, and let the criminal courts deal with that as they should, right?
Next question, audience. Sir?
A little off topic, but it deals more with the stadium deals and how it impacts the league, and I'm especially thinking about what Jerry Jones is doing right now. I saw that stadium last summer under construction. It's going to be huge, but it's also getting to the point I've heard, and I don't know if this is true, that this might be the first time that an owner has to go and ask a bank for loans. And do you think some people have maybe possibly overextended themselves in these giant construction projects where public money is going to be drying up, the economy is drawing down, and people may not want to pay huge ticket prices? I guess the new Yankee Stadium might be another example of this, where how that's going to affect overall revenue.
Everyone's looking at you, Steve.
Give us your perspective.
The entire panel looked at you, just by the way.
I have heard mixed reports about the success that the Cowboys have had in selling suites and seats and sponsorships at their stadium. Unless something's happened in the last 24 hours, they do not yet have a naming rights partner, and I don't know what they're asking for a naming rights deal. The larger deals are on that have been announced are on the order of $10 to $12 million per year for football stadiums. Well, they may have picked a bad time to build buildings that cost $1 billion because the economy is in a sure enough slump. Whether or not it's going to pull out or level out or get worse, I think is still up for grabs. If you listen to the popular media. I think there are some fundamental weaknesses in the economy. There are a ton of people out of work. My understanding is that in the Metroplex in Texas, the unemployment rate is running at about 8.5%, which is pretty steep. And if you listen to the negative things, it's going over 10% before it pulls out. And I just think it's a very bad time to be in the business of opening a new stadium. Now, from what I have seen of that building and of his deal, a good chunk of it is being paid for by the league under the G3 resolution, I think $150 million of it. They have a half-cent sales tax in the city of Arlington for the next 30 years that's being used for revenue bonds. And then I think he's selling PSLs on the order of $500 million or something like that, or trying to. And I've heard mixed reports about whether or not it's working in terms of, you know, how close he is to getting to his goal for the PSL sales. The New York Stadium, at least from what I hear, they're saying good things about their sale of PSLs, and I think at least with one of the teams, a big chunk of the tickets are not PSL'd. I think their entire upper deck is being sold on a season ticket basis without an associated license. So, and I don't know, you know, about other stadiums, but I think that for us, we're very comfortable with what we have, which was the least expensive building of its generation. It has tremendous sight lines. I'm not sure you can go to a stadium and have better sight lines than you have at LP Field. The architectural drawings and the design of the stadium is similar to a number of other stadiums that were built less expensively than some of the stadiums that are under construction now. We built that. That building was built, including demolition and construction and the acquisition of the land, for less than $300 million. The construction piece was $168 million. It does not have great finishes. You know, there's all kinds of just bare concrete everywhere. The clubs are not great. And we have sold every ticket we have ever put on sale in that building. Our ticket prices are modest compared, again, to our sister clubs. And the difficulty that we have, and I'm just trying to be as candid as I know how to be, is that when owners go and build buildings that size and sell that many tickets for that much money and raise that kind of money through suite revenue, what I wonder is, do they understand that they are part of a league that is built around everybody being competitive? Competition drives our business. The reason that there are hundreds of millions of television sets around the world watching our playoff games and Super Bowl, and zillions of households watching our regular season games, is because there's a very high level of competition. Anybody can beat anybody on Sunday, and it comes down to a few plays. Most games are decided in the fourth quarter. Many games are decided on the last play of the game. That's what people are interested in. And building the palaces that generate huge amounts of revenue, how does that further the goal of creating competition, which is what pays Tony and what pays Dennis and what pays me? That's what makes the world go round, is a high level of competition. And if you don't have that, and if people can't, if there aren't restraints put on what people can spend on talent, and there's no limitations at all of any kind, then we'll become baseball. And we'll become, hockey and all the other sports that people don't want to watch on television. And then there won't be money to pay, all the players and all the Dennises and Tonys and Steves. And everybody can say what they want to, but the reason people watch us on television and come to our stadiums to see the games is because it's great competition and great entertainment.
I think we're going to have to end on that note, Steve.
Good.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, but let's thank Tony, Rick, Dennis, and Steve for being here today.
What I was going to say is that...